a first-time guest speaker for us, Patrick Brown, originally from Chicago and now resident of Oakland. He's a graduate of the East Bay Meditation Center Commit to Dharma program, as well as the Spirit Rock Meditation Center Community Dharma Leaders Training Program, which is a multi-year, multi-retreat practice program. He's on the leadership team of the East Bay Meditation Center, People of Color Sangha, and the EBMC Alphabet Sangha, and the Alphabet Brothers of Color Deep Refuge Sangha. So, Patrick, welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here. Thank you, everybody, for your practice. Yeah, Patrick Brown. I'm excited when I got the invitation to come and share. My intention is to talk a little bit about the Dharma. I would like to introduce myself. And then I'm actually going to riff from where Dawn Haney left off last week, because she and I were working on that talk together. So I'm going to riff from there. And just really invite us into exploration again, more about what is the truth in the Dharma. It shows up in many places, and I'd love to talk and share about some of my musings on that. And then, transition the talk into more of like freedom and liberation. I woke up this morning with James Baldwin and Langston Hughes on my mind as African American History Month starts. And there's a deep connection for me between the freedom that is accessible through the Dharma and the work that I do in the world around racial equity. So then I'll go into like some freedom and liberation reflections about the Dharma. And then we'll close. So hope that sounds good. And I just want to also just mention, if folks, if you, if at any point you have access needs, if I'm speaking too quickly or too softly, don't be shy to put it in the chat. I'll try to monitor. And I've already asked for some support around timing. So I timed this earlier and it was fine, but let's see. Hopefully we'll have some time at the end for just reflections and questions. So yeah, that sounds good. I'll just introduce myself. I am from Chicago. I, grew up in the South Side, and my mother was a practitioner, right? She practiced the Dharma. She was a meditator. My father was from Cleveland, and having a Black father and a white mother, in the early 80s, it just really started to shape my identity. My father passed away when I was 5. And so I was, begrudgingly accepted into my mother's racist white family. And so I really learned how to navigate and how to code switch, So my alignment, with my racial identity is like core to who I am. That's why it shows up. And that'll become clear when I talk more about why my effort in the Dharma. But I just share that because it's important for who I am. I worked for years in nonprofits. I was doing a workforce development for formerly incarcerated folks. Was kind of my shtick. And I rode that green jobs wave for a while and ran a national program for community gardening that was driven by working with ex-offenders. As many of us do, I entered the Dharma through the doorway of suffering. I was really struggling. I was having some great professional success, but as the nonprofit industrial complex does, it took a lot from me. A lot of my cues around what was making me successful and what I wanted to do with my life were very external. I had very limited kind of knowledge or awareness of how important my inner peace was. I remember one conversation with my mom saying like, "Oh, aren't you proud of me? I'm so successful. I'm doing all these things." I was on Oprah, super excited. My mom was like, "Yes, and like, what about your internal stuff? What about your sacred, like religious perspective? Like, what about that part of your life?" But, per usual, she was right. And so I continued to burn out and burn out. And it was really graphic. It was horrible. I suffered so much. And I really got to the point where I was either going to go to jail or die. And so I was like, I have to leave. So I went to California to start anew. And the first thing I did when I got here was to go to Spirit Rock. I was like, oh, this is what Californians do. They go sit quietly in the woods. So I did. And, you know, I was a POC retreat. It was 9 days. I'd never been on retreat. I'd never been quiet for that long before. And in that retreat, my heart just broke wide open. You know, first few days, I was like, oh, thoughts come and go. You know, next couple of days, like, I don't have anything else to think about. And then the stuff started coming up. And the suffering that I had experienced early in my life really started to manifest. And I just, you know, so upset. I ran to the managers and I was like, hey, I'm like, you need to help, like get somebody, because I think I'm going to lose it. I was touching into this deep suffering that was coming out. It felt like tar. And I was like, I'm really scared that I'm going to lose it. Get someone to help me. Like a couple of people, big ones. And retreat manager brought Gina Sharp in. If you've ever heard, you've seen her, met her. She's this big. And she came and she kind of like, never met her day before in my life. And I just like, the cathartic release happened, you know, was profound. It literally changed the trajectory of my life. And so afterwards, Larry Yang was on that retreat and he said, well, you've got to come to EBMC. And I went to EBMC and I heard him talk, and he talked about the way that the Dharma was driven by, like, be a lantern unto yourself. That was a big theme from that first talk. And it just made sense to me, different than my Catholic upraising. It just made sense to me. And I attached to it in such a way that I was like, wow, I really started to experience. The more I would practice, the more my cessation of suffering was. I was like, this is incredible. I just have to know that everybody has access to this. I was queer identified, gay man out there dating in the world, new to Oakland and San Francisco, living it up. I was just aware of like how much suffering is in our communities and how much we've been marginalized as queer folks and how that trauma lives in our cells and our bodies. And I was like, that's it, I'm on it. I'm gonna learn this stuff real good and I'm gonna make it, I'm gonna teach queer people, I'm gonna teach Black people. So that was a commitment I made like 10 years ago. Thank you, Stephen. And yeah, and here I am. So it's an honor to be, you know, take a seat towards the front of the room. I hope that something I shared tonight is helpful and resonates with you. And just know that my intentions are pure. Yeah, so last week, Don Haney was speaking about truth, karma as truth. And the origin of kind of a conversation she and I had was, you know, the Four Noble Truths make a lot of sense. They're a foundational block piece to learning the Dharma. There's something that we can talk and think about for a lifetime. But what does it mean that they were truths? Why aren't they four noble ideas? Why aren't they four noble perspectives? And we've sat with, like, what does it mean to be the truth? You know, there's a translation of Dharma that means truth. And so we sat and we were like, okay, so the first noble truth, that there is suffering. And, like, there are so many ways and places in the Dharma that point us towards, you know, the suffering that is the catalyst or what can happen to push us into one of the doorways to learn more. Like, my lived experience of suffering that drove me towards, like, I needed to limit, mitigate, shrink, eliminate the suffering. And so we're like, oh, maybe that's just like, maybe it's the dynamic of it that makes it a truth. And then we considered the second noble truth, that there is a cause of the truth. The fact that there is something that you can point to that will help you in an effort to understand like truth versus just an idea, a framework. We were like, oh, the second noble truth points us towards ideas of where the root of it is, the essence of it. And that feels very tied to the word truth. And we looked at the third noble truth as like that there is an end of suffering. So this is one of my favorite, it's my favorite of the four noble truths. The end of suffering comes. What does that look like? The end of suffering, the most present example in my life is as my mother transitioned. I lost my mother December 2nd, 2015, and she transitioned. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life. And years from then, I have a broader perspective. And we had talked about how her body was not serving her the way that it was. You know, she had a quality of life that was not, you know, what she wanted it to be. And she was deep in her practice, and yet there was a relief. And I can see that from where I am now. So that the end of suffering, hard concept to hold and to admit, but that for me to admit that there was an end of suffering for her as her body, you know, she transitioned out of her body, right? I'm starting to get the flavor of poignancy of like, what does truth really mean? And then the last noble truth that there is a pathway that we can follow. And, you know, I love that Buddhism offers an invitation as opposed to more didactic and the more like 10 commandments or something. You know, like I love that it's a little bit, you know, here's some guidelines for you as opposed to do this or else. And so that started to feel the quality, the texture of truth as well. So, you know, we went back and forth for a while and just wanted to acknowledge that truth seems to be connected to like significance and to poignancy and to like powerful ideas that are deeply resonant and less, you know, so then I want to talk about where that took me. You know, another place where the Dharma shows up talking about the truth is the two truths. We have the relative truth and absolute truths. And these, you know, this teaching is very rich, and I'm going to read from Thich Nhat Hanh's The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, way to kind of outline where those two truths are. Thich Nhat Hanh says, according to Buddhism, there are two kinds of truth, relative or worldly truth and absolute truth. We enter the door of practice through relative truth. We recognize the presence of happiness and the presence of suffering. And as we try to go in the direction of increased happiness, every day we go a little further in that direction. And one day we realize that suffering and happiness are not two. So just an introduction to the idea that there are relative truths that we experience in our day-to-day life. This is the truth of the decay of my body. This is the truth of we have to pay rent every month. This is the truth of, you know, the conditions that create, you know, the conditions within Sangha that are challenging and personality, that these are relative truths. He goes on to say, there's a poem. People talk endlessly about their suffering and their joy, but what is there to suffer or be joyful about? Joy from sensual pleasure always leads to pain, and suffering while practicing the way always brings joy. Wherever there is joy, there is suffering. If you want to have non-suffering, you must accept no joy. So, pointing towards the absolute truth, this is the content that is there. In the world, it's true that we are all connected. That these identities, right? This identity of self, this identity of this body, Patrick, identity of like in a sangha, that there are relationships that are keep are separate, right? This delusion and greed show up, and like there's a higher truth, the absolute truth, that those are. Those are not real. And so the absolute truth points us towards the higher version of myself and this way that I can think of and understand that, yeah, there are big truths that are more relevant than the small truths. But I just am pointing towards my mind's intention to like try and wrestle with those. And I'll make it more clear this way. Ever been on, you know, if you've ever been on retreat and you've noticed that people are suffering, and as they're sharing their stories, the teacher will invite them to, you know, take a step back from yourself, right? Anatta, like you are not your suffering, right? To pull them towards the larger, like absolute truth. Or if you've ever been in conversation, you know, I'm in a lot of places at the East Bay Meditation Center where, we talk about race so much, and we talk about queerness so much, and it can be very uncomfortable for people that are wanting to come and sit and have a pleasant, you know, meditation. But the reason we push and drive that is because it is the lived experience. And so often when we introduce that content of race or, you know, orientation or gender identity within the Dharma, people are quick to say, well, that's not the truth. The truth is larger than that. We are more than that. That is not where you should spend your attention and focus, because that's not the truth that Buddha said. And so we refer to this as like spiritual circumvention, right? It's a way to get around kind of this difficult content that people don't are uncomfortable sitting with. So that frustrates me. And then, you know, as I'm thinking about it, there it goes the other way as well. For work, I do a lot of, I'm a consultant. I work with companies that want to advance racial equity and gender equity in these pieces. And oftentimes, you know, it's called to for people to do an analysis of hierarchy and power, privilege, and authority. And so in those spaces, it's often through that people are, you know, well, I can't speak up because I don't, you know, I'm only a consultant, only a receptionist. I don't feel like I have the authority to say what I need to say to the CEO. Or it's a negotiation of, you know, the resources that I have are less than they have, so I have to be careful about how I navigate that because I don't have any power. And in those places, I find myself wondering, well, that's not true. Like your power in one way, right, in the relative truth, is limited by hierarchy, power, privilege, authority, the history of, you know, systems of oppression. But your actual power, like your everyday breath, right, your ancestors, your history, like the fact that you can make decisions every moment, like you actually are really empowered. You have the most power over what you do. And so like inviting people to do the reverse, whereas, you know, to think about the larger truth, like this suffering that you're experiencing is temporary, it will not sustain, will not last forever. And trouble don't last always. Like you can invite that larger absolute truth to be helpful for people that are struggling with, you know, thinking that their power is limited by their identity or where they are. So isn't that funny? I've talked myself all the way through a round circle. You know, like, is it the relative truth? Is it the absolute truth? But I just want to point to the fact that it's actually both, and that we do a dance, and that when we miss each other sometimes in these talks with the Dharma, we are often, it's because one of us is talking relative truth and the other is talking absolute truth. Alrighty. Second reading. This is how you can tell how nervous I am, because I read from a lot of books when I get nervous. All right, this is a little bit more about relative and ultimate truth. Again, this is from Touching Peace. It's another Thich Nhat Hanh book. We come to practice the practice of meditation, seeking relief from our suffering. And meditation can teach us how to transform our suffering and obtain basic relief. But the deepest kind of relief is the realization of nirvana. There are two dimensions of life that we should be able to touch both. One is the wave, and we call it the historical dimension. The other is like the water, and we call it the ultimate dimension of nirvana. We usually just touch the wave, but when we discover how to touch the water, we receive the highest fruit the meditation can offer. So being aware of the ultimate truth, the idea of awakening, or the idea that we're reaching nirvana, right, is the juiciest, the highest fruit that can be offered from our meditation practice. And so I sit with that over and over again to determine, like, well, is that why I sit and I practice? How do we hold both of those truths? How are they related? You know, is it the suffering that causes the freedom? Is the relationship, does it invert, you know, and when? Because what it drives me towards is, why do I practice? So I will invite the question of, why do you practice? If you are intending to, you don't have to raise your hand or anything, but just acknowledge to yourself if you believe that you will awaken in this lifetime. Maybe yes, maybe no. But the question is, if you don't believe that, if you're not sure of that, then what is the, why do you practice? Because if the goal is to awaken, and you realize that it may not happen this lifetime, then what truth are you seeking, and what efforts are you putting forth towards, you know, towards this practice? If you're not, if you don't think you're going to awaken in this life, in that body, then the work that you put towards it becomes, there's some other reason that it's worth the investment. And that's where I want to lean into suffering as a mechanism to drive our liberation, drive towards freedom. I've discovered within myself that part of the reason I am so justice oriented and the reason I gear my life professionally towards advancing social equity, racial equity, gender equity, is because it is the best step I can make towards my own freedom. I sat with Kay Taylor. She's she reads charts, zodiac work and charts, last week. And she pointed towards my double Pisces and Virgo rising. She was like, oh yeah, you are justice through and through. You are trying to solve some stuff here on the planet. And, you know, and one of the questions I asked her was like, would I be better at a different job? Could I have a less stressful job? And she was like, maybe. But your purpose is to really drive justice. That's in your chart. That's in your stars. It just resonated so real. And I kept thinking, well, you know, it is hard. The practice of the Dharma is hard. The practice of my job is hard. And so when I start to accept that the reason I work in these hard places, the Dharma and my job, when I think about it really still and quietly, it's because it helps me to heal. My devotion, my practice, my service has this component of it that is really about healing myself. So suffering is freedom, right? So if suffering is the catalyst that drives so many, there's 10,000 doorways to the Dharma, 80,000, you know, there's a catalyst for each of us that brings us here. And so many of them are based in suffering that it's worthwhile to think about, you know, what the advantage of that suffering is as it drives the catalyst for us to change and for us to learn and confront the difficult things within the practice. One of my favorite things to do as a Dharma teacher is to invite folks to just turn up the heat a little bit on your practice. You know, we can plateau, we can become very calm and complacent, and we meet on Mondays and I sit for 30 minutes and I listen for 30 minutes and then I go back to my rest of my week. And what does it mean to turn up your practice so that this week is different than next week? That you are spending more time exploring, you know, wise speech or another component of the Dharma and lessons learned. I want to point at, we have 5 minutes left? No. I want to point, sorry?
About three.
Okay, I'm gonna wrap it up and say that the struggle drives the practice. The practice takes us on a path towards freedom. I'd love to read more, but I'm out of time. I recommend, when we talk about the practice and struggle towards freedom, Radical Dharma comes up. And Spring Washam's book of A Fierce Heart. There's wonderful pieces in there about how the struggle gets shaped towards freedom. And I will quickly read. No, I won't. There's no time for that. I will acknowledge that I ran out of time and that I hope that something I said resonated. I ask for your grace and forgiveness for any harm I may have caused. My intention was to be helpful. Thank you for your practice.
Patrick, thank you. Thank you so much. We have a few minutes left, so what we do now, let's sit together and we'll dedicate the merit of our time together. So let's sit. as we come together tonight to practice and listen to the Dharma, may any merit that has been generated by our time and practice together, may it be for the benefit of each and every one of us, and may that benefit spread to all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness in their life. And may all beings be healthy in body and in mind. May all of us and all beings everywhere be safe from all forms of danger and harm. And may we all and all beings live with ease and well-being. And ultimately, may all beings everywhere be free. Patrick, thank you again for that really wonderful personal Dharma talk. It's a pleasure to have you with us. We hope you can join us again. We're totally self-organized, self-supporting.